south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came up to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. One of the hottest topics people seem to email me about is doing business in Latin America, since I would say about half the people who come down here permanently think or feel that somewhere along the line they'll have to have a job. Not just to keep busy, but because their nest egg is small, they know that sometime or another they'll have to survive, so they'll have to make some money, somehow. By the way, most expats who come down with a nest egg, large or small, vastly underestimate the period of time it'll last them here. That is, unless you're on the Gringo Tourist Trail, then you can pretty much use first world cost of living numbers. And for those expats who live in the famous Altiplano regions of Latin America, remember, you'll have no heating or air conditioning bill. Besides the fact, when you buy local produce, you'll be paying about a quarter to a fifth of what you pay in the States, unless you go to Walmart or Costco to buy imported and processed stuff. But you knew that already, right? Now, for young expat gonna-bes and wannabes in their 20s and 30s that come down, almost all of them feel that somewhere along the line they'll have to have a job once they get here. Number one, who retires that young? And who has a big enough nest egg at that age to sit around and suck on umbrella drinks all day? But luckily, you see, most people in their 20s and 30s are really IT savvy, and the greater proportion of them, once they get down here, find their niche in doing some kind of business on the net. And with an internet business, of course, there's a very minimal outlay initially, starting with that huge savings because you won't need to have an office or a building. You can work out of the home. So you probably won't need much of a staff or delivery people or inventory or a parking lot or security, etc., etc. So down here, as with the first world, when you talk about dirt cheap startup costs anywhere, that would be with an internet business. I'd say most of the under 40, even the under 50 crowd, are thinking along those lines. Meaning, most young expats that come down have that IT edge going for them. But some don't. You see, a lot of new, fresh, young expats come down because they did some kind of NGO work, Peace Corps, whatever. And even though they're on social media all the time and have smartphones, they're not that internet savvy. Down here, you meet people like that all the time. They're down here for 2, 3, even 6 months. They love it so much that they vow someday they're going to come back and live the life for good. And some do. Many of them having pretty much useless college degrees in drama, the humanities, history, psychology, sociology, etc. In fact, you'll find a good percentage of backpacker types without a solid business background. For them, it was mostly liberal arts all the way. If you were to interview some young Peace Corps types and do-gooders, you'd find that out in a hurry. Now, this might not come as much of a surprise to you, but there's statistical evidence up in the first world anyway, pointing out that kids whose parents worked for the man all their life will probably work for the man all their lives too. By the way, that goes for kids whose parents worked government jobs. They're more likely to work for the government later in life too. What a revolting development, huh? As opposed to kids whose parents were small business owners, they too are more inclined to start their own businesses and become their own boss. Now, expat Eddie, who's got a Latin American rags-to-riches story in the restaurant business, he tells me he's known a lot of people whose parents had small businesses, whether they went bust or not. He says that environment instills a kind of a lifelong confidence in a kid, as it did in his case. He says guys like himself have no fear of failure when doing a business startup. Not until you find out you can't make next month's rent anyway. By the way, when Eddie was a kid up in the States, his mother had a succession of businesses. A pool hall, a diner, a coffee shop, a Jiffy Lube, and they all went bust. But she kept on plugging away. So that was Eddie's training ground. However, if your mom was a teacher all her life and your dad operated the drop forge at the Chrysler plant for 37 years, their kids would probably like nothing better than to work for the man. After all, it's a secure job forever and you get that pension. For their kids, the thought of starting a business could be quite scary. Which is why a lot of young backpacking expats come down and want to work for call centers or as English teachers at a private helicopter school because, well, though the pay is not so good, both those jobs are nice and secure. So what about slightly older expat gonna-bes and wannabes who really need or think they need to have a job once they finally get down here to Latin America? People, let's say, in their 50s and 60s and not necessarily so technically plugged in. I mean, let's face it. I'm one of those guys, too. No one stuck earbuds in my head or an iPhone in my hand when I was born. Most people of my generation and older feel much more confident opening up a brick-and-mortar business than starting an IT company, that's for sure. So right now, we'll talk a bit more about just that. So for all of you who've been asking for more expatity stories and listeners who've been asking me to report on the continuing adventures of Captain Mango, well, today, Captain Mango himself tells us his own convoluted story of the trials and tribulations of doing business here in Latin America when you're a gringo that speaks very little Spanish. And since I always insist we talk about the good, bad, the ugly, and the great, let's hear some of the ugly from our own Captain Mango, who's been down here in Central America now for the last 3 years. By the way, he was one of those guys who had parents back up in the States who had their own mom and pop business. So he is one of those guys with a low fear factor of starting a new business. So let's get on with it. Johnny, here's an example of some of the BS you got to deal with if you're going to try to do business by the book here in Latin America. As some of your listeners know, I invested in a taxi business a couple of years ago in a Central American city of over 1 million population. In order to do this, at least for these particular taxis in this location, one needs to purchase the parking rights for each car one wishes to put into service. This right comes with a number for the vehicle in the zone in the city it's registered in. Now, remember, every city in Latin America has its districts or zones. You might call these zones neighborhoods, but they're actually much, much bigger than a normal neighborhood. So then, you buy the number for the vehicle in the zone where it's registered in. This number is then displayed on the doors and hood of the car. For example, 780, zone 10. That's my Latin partner's number for the particular car he operates. Now here, the limit for the age of a taxi is 15 years. So when a car is 15 years old, you can no longer put it on the street as a taxi. I purchased several taxis and their corresponding parking rights and numbers. Now, as you say, Johnny, this being the land of non-maintenance and mechanical neglect, a couple of the cars were so worn out and beat up, they needed to be replaced well before their 15-year expiration date. This being the case, last August, I purchased 3 cars in slightly used state to take the place of the worn-out cars that were now pretty much junks. Now, one would think this should be a relatively easy task to make the transition from a new car to replace an older junk. Nothing prepared me, though, for what was to come. It is convoluted, so let's start with number one. Number one was to locate the appropriate vehicle titles and transfer them to my Latin partner in his name. And why is that? Well, I'm still on a tourist visa and have to go in and out of the country every 90 days and cannot operate a taxi business as a tourist. Which is why, in this case, I either needed a gringo partner with permanent residency or a Latin partner who obviously has citizenship. Now, step two is to paint all the cars white and then have the titles reflect this change. Step three, liquidate the junk vehicles, take those cars out of service with the intention of putting replacement cars into the freshly vacated positions. Note the time limit for a vacant parking spot to be held for you after you've taken a car out of service is 90 days, after which that $3,000 spot reverts back to the city. So you've got 90 days to get another car through the process and put it in that spot. Again, the going rate for that spot's a one-time cost of around $3,000. Step four, obtain public plates and install taxi signs on the roofs and corresponding numbers to the cars. Then schedule the ludicrous government taxi inspection. So then what would you think? Would all that take a month, maybe 6 weeks at the most? Well, guess again, you're dealing with the government, so you'll put up with a lot of manure, a lot of mañana time, topped off with still more manure. Let's take step one, for example. The smiling government babe that happily took my money and promised 2 titles within a week took, get this, a month to produce them. But she was ever so happy to serve me and sincere about those promises. However, by the time we were finished with the whole business, she would not even greet me or acknowledge my existence. Then, get this, after several attempts to transfer the titles, they forgot a hyphen on one of the documents, which meant another day in line for my Latin partner. Oh, and regarding step two, did you know that in order to change the color of a vehicle in Latin America, one must present a receipt from the body shop for the paint job? However, since tax evasion is the national sport, you can't fault them for that, The painter is not about to submit a proper receipt for the full amount of the job because he doesn't wish to report this as income and pay tax on it. So in my case, the government office that is in charge of car titles refused my first attempt to show proper change of color, claiming there's no way anyone would paint a car for such a small amount of money. So they said, we can't accept this receipt, bring another one. So then I went back and got another receipt, this time for about half of what it costs to do the paint job, instead of one-tenth the cost of the paint job, as with the first rejected receipt. So then after waiting another 4 to 6 hours in a government line, the permission was granted to have the color change inspected prior to the title change. So yes, you actually have to have permission to get it inspected. Yet another line to stand in with your thumb up your ass. Well, at least it was my partner's thumb and my partner's ass. Let's be perfectly clear about that. Anyway, so far so good. The inspection passed and the titles were authorized to have the color changed to white. How long did that take? Well, a full day for inspections. And they said, come back next week to pick up the new titles. Now, I'll bet you didn't know that there is exactly one and only one lazy-ass government slug in this country of 15 million people or so who is able to process this particular bureaucratic step. And she happened to need a few days off. This was the first week of December. And the next lazy-ass government slug at the window did not give us much hope that any of this could be accomplished before the new year. Telling us, well, the holidays are coming and, you know, not much gets done with all the parties and such. So bottom line, just a warning here, if you're dealing with anything at all that has to do with the government, you can pretty much write off the month of December. Meanwhile, step three is in the works while the other issues are being tended to. Now remember, the 90-day period has expired, 100% due to the blundering inefficiencies of government. And the extension has been applied for so as to not lose my $3,000 investment, times three, for three cars, for that necessary government space you have to buy for each car when you're in the taxi business. But do note that for a small fee and an extra day in line, the extension is granted. And you know, it seems like for every paperwork step with the government, there's a time limit, and most people go beyond that time limit. So, surprise, surprise, they're able to get an extension by paying a small fee. What a racket, huh? By the way, in Latin America, the same thing happens if you overstay your 90-day tourist visa. You can pay $50 and stand in line for a half a day and get another 90-day extension. I repeat, what a racket. Okay, so I got the extension. The old taxis were taken out of service. The public plates were returned to the government and retired. And now for the final step. Hooray, hooray, I don't believe it. Step four. Yes, the titles are correct. The color is white and approved. And we are authorized to put taxi signs on the roof and the numbers on the cars. But wait, there's a last-minute mix-up. One of the government slugs crossed up the paperwork and transposed the numbers on the car. It's okay, right? They'll fix it. It's their fault. BS. It's simpler to remove the number from our two cars and switch them than to get the government to admit and fix their own mistake, which cost me another $100 and two more days of screwing around. So now, 5 months later, we finally have the new cars in service. Yep, almost like having a baby. 5 months. Actually, a half a baby. This doesn't mean all is well, though. Turns out one of our new taxi drivers must have gotten drunk or lost in a card game and somehow managed to lose the rear plate off of the taxi. So what's that mean? Well, if a cop pulls it over, a fine every time. Oh, shit. I guess I can look forward to another maze of lines at government offices. So that's what it took for me to do legitimate business in a developing nation. More to come, and by the way, still campaigning against killer coconuts, Captain Mango. Well, thanks for that, Captain Mangle, and it does reinforce the fact that we never really want to do any kind of business at all with any Latin government. They're all the same. But then again, that's the way it is up in the States, too, huh? Whereas Expatity says the lines are much shorter up there, but the fines, fees, and penalties are out of this world compared to down here in Latin America. Now, I have to admit, I do admire Captain Mangle for jumping into a business venture like this so early into his time down here in Latin America. Meanwhile, let me tell you what I've learned from all my experience having at least 13 different businesses here in Latin America myself. And what I'm going to say now applies to pretty much every Latin country. Number one, if you're going to have a brick and mortar business or any business at all that has a big capital investment, you should always set up an anonymous SA corporation to put the assets in and to open your bank account, etc. That way you don't have to get involved with number two, a Latin partner. Now, as you business owners up in the States probably know by now, having a partner is like being married, and you have to have a lot of trust in that partner. And when things are going good and you're making money, you're the best of friends. And when they're not, you just might want to stick them in the eye with a hot poker. And then there always, and I mean always, comes a time when you think you're doing more work than your partner. And he's thinking the same thing, that he's doing more work than you are. Well, let's just say that 9 out of 10 partnerships are doomed to failure before they even get started. And unfortunately, even if the business is a success, you usually end up being less and less friendly toward each other. Sound familiar? That's not to say there aren't some very good gringo Latin business partnerships. I've been in a very good one like that myself, but only once. And my other experience with Latin partners? Not so good at all. In fact, I've had pretty much the same dismal record when partnering up with gringos, too. So yes, I've had my share of business failures, and my successes almost always came when I did things on my own. Now, as far as the successful Latin/gringo partnerships that I've seen, they seem to have one thing in common. Both the gringo and the Latin guy have an equal or nearly equal amount of dough invested in the business. They both have an equal amount of skin in the game. However, what happens most times is that it's a lopsided relationship. The gringo comes down with his dough. He doesn't know Spanish. In fact, it really sucks. He wants to start a business quite badly and feels he needs to have a Latin partner to succeed. And Latins with great ideas and no dough somehow have a certain radar, and it doesn't take much, for spotting gringos just like that anxious to start a business. Gringos that don't know the language, the culture, or the ropes. Now, I'm not talking about clueless gringos here. These are very astute, smart gringos who quite possibly had successful businesses up in the States. But soon enough, you find you're not in Kansas or Cleveland anymore. So at first, it seems like a partnership made in heaven. Your Latin guy knows all the angles, knows all the people, claims he's got an in because he's got relatives in government, knows suppliers, can get things done cheap, etc., etc. And you're the first world gringo detail guy, the forward thinker, the guy with the marketing sense, and best of all, the guy with the dough. Hey, I know, I've been in a few business situations like that, but only a long time ago before I really knew my Spanish. But back to this SA Corporation thing. If you're going to start a brick and mortar business, you have to get yourself an SA Corporation, even if it costs you $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 to get started, and you have to pay a monthly maintenance fee of $50 or $100. Forever. But if you have a brick-and-mortar business, it's definitely worth it. That way you don't have to put the business, the inventory, the capital, and the bank account in anyone else's name. Everything's under the umbrella of your SA Corp. Now, here's something I've been hearing for over 2 decades, and for some, it's almost become a mantra. Countless gringos are convinced in order to have a legit business, they have to have a Latin partner. They think it's the law. In fact, a very good friend of mine in Costa Rica got sucked into a deal like that. And he's got a fantastic, thriving business. He owns cars and houses and beachfront property, etc., except he really doesn't own it. They started that business over 20 years ago with only about $2,000, and it was the gringo's $2,000. The Latin guy had no skin in the game. But now he owns the game because everything's in his name. It was from the start. Now, my Latin buddy did get advice at the time to open an SA Corp, but he didn't think it was worth the grand or so it took to set it up. He told me at the time he thought, well, businesses fail all the time, and what if I buy this SA Corp, the business failed, and I've got to pay that monthly nut, basically paying for a dead horse. So it is true, in order to get some of the licenses and permits, you have to be a local resident or citizen. However, with an SA Corporation, you can get around all of that. And I think when I first came down, I didn't know the ins and outs of an SA Corporation for 4 or 5 years. I guess that's because newbie expats are not known for coming down to a tropical paradise, sitting around the pool and talking about SA Corps. That said, let's talk about how your business can inadvertently end up partnering up with the local Latin government. Now, because there are so very few things that Latin governments can regulate, when it does involve something like taxis, which involve yearly license renewals and actual inspections and stuff, it doesn't take government long to put you in a stranglehold and a straitjacket, as Captain Mangos found out. Which is why the ideal business down here is an IT business, because there's virtually zero government involvement, zero permits, etc. And by the way, most other brick-and-mortar mom-and-pop businesses have very, very, very minimal government involvement, too. Sure, for the first month, You and your lawyer and his tramitador, that's the guy that does all the paperwork and runs around in a motorcycle to all the government offices, are going to waste a lot of time standing in lines. However, once you've got those permits to operate, you'll almost never have to deal with the government again. And you'll probably never see an inspector again either. And there's a good chance you never saw one in the first 30 days either. And by the way, if you sell services and supplies, try not to get a government contract because chances are you won't get paid or the check will bounce. Which was exactly what happened to me when I did some English voiceover spots on some tourism commercials that appeared on international airline flights. So now, every once in a while, when I'm flying, I hear my own voice in a commercial I never got paid for. Kind of makes me want to stick a hot poker in a bureaucrat's eye. So anyway, right around the time I did the voiceovers, there was an election, a change of governments, and no one with old contracts got paid. Now, let's talk about the care and feeding of your business and the capital equipment therein. By the way, you'll be responsible for that, because like Captain Mango said, care, maintenance, and details don't exist here in Latin America, unless you do the training and in heavy rotation. Anyway, Captain Mango mentioned one of his drivers lost the plate on the car through negligence or whatever. And you know, in Latin America, that's par for the course. So note, if you have a business down here and have some complicated and expensive machines, don't ever expect them to last as long as the same machines would up in the first world. In fact, Expat Eddie whines about it all the time. He tells me that he's got a lot of these four-station espresso machines at his restaurants, those Italian jobs that cost between $2,500 and $5,000. And since they're dealing with steam and pressure and milk and hot water and coffee grounds, they have to be specially cared for and maintained daily. And Eddie says if he's not on his people all the time, they break down with monotonous regularity. He said one way to solve that problem is to put one person and one person only in charge of the maintenance on the machine. And, Eddie said, when you're not there, you can assume the workers will slack off, like workers up in the first world will too. Now, there's no better way to drive that point home than to mention the times I've been a passenger in Latin Americans' cars. It always strikes me funny when I see one or two idiot lights glowing on the dashboard in the car. Yet, the guy keeps driving his car, and the next time I see him, same thing. The idiot lights are still on. That is, if the car's not in the shop or the junkyard. It seems as if most Latins have never been told what those idiot lights are for. Low oil, engine overheating, whatever. I mean, come on, why do you think they call them idiot lights? Once I remember telling a Latin guy that's what they were called, and he looked at me like I was joking. No matter how I tried to convince him, he wouldn't believe it. That would be luces de idiota in Espanol. Meanwhile, up in the States, when the idiot lights come on, you know the clock's ticking and you better visit a mechanic soon. Most likely that very day. Oh, and get this. Many times I've looked for used cars here in Latin America. Been here a long time, so I've been through a lot of cars. And when I do, I always try to buy a car through a private owner instead of a dealership. Because then you're more likely to see the car as it really is, not detailed out and tweaked like a dealership would do. Note that a private owner could never disguise an idiot light that's been on continuously like an engine check light. If you have one of those, you know that could cost a couple $100 to get diagnosed and fixed. Whereas at a dealership, as one mechanic told me, if it's a costly or complicated problem and the car seems to run okay, they'll just pull the bulb out from behind the dash and sell the car like that without telling you, of course. Now, I don't think most gringos would buy a used car that had an idiot light that was on continuously. But Latins do, and they rarely ever pop the question, why is that light on? And if they do, the seller will just say something like, well, it's always on. Was like that when I bought it. No problem. So then, when you hire Latin workers, can you see what you're up against? Now, that's not to say they aren't very good, dedicated workers, because most of them are. Except the ones in government, of course. But when you hire Latin workers for your own brick-and-mortar business, you have to make an employee handbook that spells out everything step-by-step that needs to be done by each individual employee. That includes the maintenance procedure and scheduling for all your machines. And of course, those manuals will have to be in Spanish. And no matter how detailed your employee handbook is, you'll still have to do a show and tell and review it every month or so. Now, another great example of what you're up against, I mentioned in a past show a while ago, that most upscale Latins, people in the upper middle class and wealthy class, like to have all the modern appliances in the kitchen. That means a washing machine, which is used daily, and a gas or electric dryer, which gets used for a while and then usually falls along the wayside because the cleaning lady does not really know how to operate it and, in fact, is afraid to use it. And there's one thing I noticed throughout Latin America in regards to automatic washing machines. They almost always fill at an extremely slow rate. A dribble. Sometimes it takes 15 minutes to a half an hour just for the drum to fill with water and the cycle to begin. Same thing for the rinse cycle, etc. And I used to think up to 5 or 10 years ago, that's because the water pressure in most subdivisions is extremely low. And if you're on city municipal water, it's even worse. You're on a slow trickle forever. You're lucky sometimes if it's coming out at the thickness of a pencil. Anyway, when I first got down here, I figured that slow filling of the washing machine was due to bad water pressure. But I was wrong, because upper middle class and wealthy people anyway, and new subdivisions have adequate pressure, with private pumps and big cisterns. So, can you guess why the flow is so low? Because no one ever bothers to change that inline little screen filter right where the hot and cold water hoses connect to the back of the washing machine. In fact, I don't think I've ever met a Latin who knows those little filters even exist. But all you have to do is unplug the hoses from the machine and they'll pop right out. Then you clean the gunk out and you're in business again. So what do Latins do? They wait until the dribs and drabs are so small and it takes so long to fill the machine they call a repairman. Then he'll clean or replace those filters and charge 15 or 20 bucks. However, once when I was in Costa Rica, a washing machine repair guy told me the item that fails most and is most replaced is the solenoid valve that lets the water in to the machine. They fail because they're not designed to be in the on position for so long, cycled so many times through the day. So that's the part that's most stocked and the easiest problem to avoid. Details, details, huh? Now, there is one sure way to avoid all that gunk going through your water pipes and ending up in your appliances. Install a nice big canister filter on the cold inlet pipe to your house. The one I use is around 2 foot tall, bought it at a pool supply place. Costs around 30 or 40 bucks, and I put a 25 micron sediment filter in there, which I change about twice a year. Oh, and by the way, when Captain Mango first told me of his idea to start a taxi business and ran the numbers by me, it sounded really good. The wild card for me was the fact that you're trusting a Latin person with your car 24/7. On top of that, you're in kind of an unholy alliance with the government. So in a business like that, it looks like you're going to bat with two strikes against you from the get-go. However, people are making a go of it. There are plenty of taxi companies throughout Latin America. Not to mention Uber's moved in too. So good luck, Captain Mango. You live and learn, right? Okay, we're near the end now, so don't forget to go to www.thenewexpat.com and check out master blogger John Galt. I'm on that site too. And don't forget to go to my Expat Files YouTube channel, courtesy of Jane Galt, and follow along with the slides. Do subscribe. It's free.
South of the border.
You've been listening to the Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want me to help you sort out your own Latin American plans, schedule a one-on-one consult with me. Just send an email and let me know at theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.